Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain and on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast.
And make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
Our guest this week wrote one of my favorite books, Lucy in the Afternoon, which focuses on his time with Lucille Ball in the last days of her life. Plus, he wrote and starred in Zero Hour, a one-man show about the life and legacy of Zero Mostel.
He is also the writer of the Ovation Award-winning musical The Big Voice, God or Merman, The Last Session, Cooking with Gus, and others. Plus, he has also starred in such works as The Man Who Came to Dinner, The Sunshine Boys, and Fiddler on the Roof.
To tell us what it was like to learn comedy from David Burns, be inspired by Ethel Merman, and to beat Lucy in backgammon, here is the epitome of character man, Jim Brochu. Jim!
I sound fascinating.
You are!
Boy, I'm impressed with myself. Just sitting here, listening to all this.
That was just our intro, too.
That was just the intro.
And
that
coming out from behind the curtain now?
Yes, this is us peeking out.
Just, yeah, I mean, I see what they look like, and I know why they're behind the curtain.
Maybe that's why you can only hear us.
That's why we don't want to scare the audience.
Faces that were made for radio.
Yeah, they're my favorite compliment. You know, yesterday somebody said I look like Richard Deacon from the Dick Van Dyke Show.
I can see that a little, Robert. I
think
can see that.
That's a compliment, though, right, Jim?
Yeah, yeah. He was
okay.
A funny guy.
Okay, good. Then I'll
take it. Yeah, no, he was a good guy.
Speaking of funny guys, you're hysterical.
Oh. That's what I'm sitting on. So.
Now, did you grow up in New York?
I did. I grew up in Bay Ridge, not far from you. In Sheepshead Bay, yeah. The family used to go to Lundy's.
Oh?
On a Sunday and eat fish, which I hated. I've never eaten fish in
my
life.
Not a fish guy?
No, and I intend never to eat lips that touch.
I'm right there with you.
Will never touch mine.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Congratulations on that honor.
I used to go to Sheepshead Bay, and then I'd make everybody stop at Coney Island so I could have a Nathan's hot dog.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
How did you get it?
How did I get it? I paid for it. What do you mean? How did I get it?
Jim would steal the hot dogs from Nathan's.
I would not. I'm a very reputable person.
Ketchup? Mustard?
No, plain.
Plain?
Just
you're a plain guy.
No, not a mustard or a ketchup.
Wow.
All right. No, and their French fries, they were always great. There used to be a Nathan's at the corner of 43rd and Broadway. Do you remember
yes,
that?
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
And it was
about.
A two-level. It's where I think NASDAQ is there now.
Yeah.
And after 70 Girls, Hans Conried and I... That's where he used to go. Other stars went to Sardi's. Hans Conried wanted Nathan's hot dogs. So after 70 Girls, we'd go down to Nathan's and down to the lower level where there were tables and have our hot dogs.
He deserves it. He was a talented
man. He did.
Man.
He was an incredible man. He had such a vocabulary, and he was so sweet, and he was just dear. And
did you remember what the first Broadway musical was that you saw, or the first
please.
Broadway show? What? Oh, here we go.
Bring it.
What is
well,
it?
Well, no, it was life changing. It
what
was absolutely life changing. Up until the time I was 13 years old, I was so involved in the Catholic Church, and you know, and looking back on it, the church was theater.
Yeah.
Yes. There was a stage, there were costumes, there were music, and I was just entranced. And I knew it was my destiny to be the first Brooklyn-born Pope. No,
really?
Other kids would practice baseball. I would practice coming out onto the balcony of St. Peter's and blessing the crowd. And then one afternoon, my father came home, and he said, Ed Zimmerman, his pal from work, Ed Zimmerman was the CPA for my father's company. Dad worked on Wall Street in the municipal bond department. So he came home, and he said, Ed got us Ethel's house seats for Gypsy. And I said, what's that? And he said, you know, Ethel Merman. I didn't know who. So I went out, and I got a record of hers. In fact, it was Annie, Get Your Gun. And I thought, wow, this voice is something else. So June 20th, 1959, I was 12 years old, and we sat in Ethel Merman's house seats, and I had the first religious experience I ever had in my life, something that had never happened in church. I couldn't move after this was over. just could not move. And all of a sudden, Ed Zimmerman appeared next to us, and he said, "Ethel's waiting." So he took us backstage. The stage door of the Broadway Theater was on the other side. There was a parking lot there at 52nd Street. So that's where the stage door was. And we went in, and Ethel was still on the stage. The curtain was down. They were moving the wagons from the show around, and she was talking to the stage manager. I remember that one ghost light was there. And she had gone out with my father a couple of times. My father was a widower, so he took her dancing a couple of times. And so over she comes in that violet dress, the lavender dress she had on after Rose's turn. She said, "Hiya, Pop. Hiya, Pete. You must be Jimmy." I couldn't speak. And she said, "So what are you going to be when you grow up?" And at that moment, the curtain of the Broadway Theater rose. And there was the dark, empty theater with the people picking up programs. And I said, "I'm going to do this, Miss Merman." She said, "Good for you." And that was kind of the end of it. But
oh my God.
I knew at that moment that my life had changed.
That is
that is incredible.
Unbelievable. Your first Broadway musical was Gypsy.
And
and you met her afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
In her house. I mean, all of that is so magical.
Yeah.
Truly magical.
Yeah, it really was. It really was. And, you know, then I got to work with her years later.
Oh, yeah?
And, yeah, and it wasn't great. You know, I would see her through the years.
Yeah.
You know, you saw on my wall that picture of the two of us on my 30th birthday.
Yeah.
And that was in L.A. And so that night we all went out for Chinese food. There was about six of us. And we went to, I think it was Trader Vic's under the Beverly Hilton Hotel. And the six of us sat at the table. And the first words out of Ethel's mouth, "I don't share."
That's what I would expect. I mean, it really is.
And she didn't.
Nor should she. Nor should she.
Oh, and the time I worked with her, it was a PBS show called Musical Comedy Tonight that you probably know about.
Yeah.
Sylvia Fine.
Yes.
Where they recreated four shows.
We talked about it, right?
Yeah.
From four eras.
Yeah.
And this was the first one. And I was Stan Harris. He was the director, and I was his assistant. So Ethel came in, "Little Jimmy Brochu, what are you doing here?" And I said, "Well, we're going to be working great." She said, "We'll go out after." I said, "Okay." They were recreating Anything Goes. And Peter Matz was in the pit. And Stan Harris, the director, said, "Okay, let's do a run-through of this." She said, "What's the song?" And Peter said, "It's Anything Goes, Ethel. I don't know that song. Don't give me songs I don't know." And she wasn't kidding. She was not kidding. And we all froze. And we knew something was wrong. So Stan said, "Take her to the dressing room. Tell her we have a technical problem." So I did. And about 20 minutes later, he said, "Go check on her," and knocked on the door. And in fact, there's another picture on the wall that she signed that day of her at the microphone. But she said, is it all cleared up?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, let's go." And Stan said, "Are you ready for Anything Goes?" She said, "Let's do it." And what you see on the tape is the result of that.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I would never have known.
And it was a little, we thought it was kind of the beginning of the brain tumor. And it was affecting her. And at the end of the day, I said, "Do you still want to go out?" And she said, "Honey, I'm so tired." And I said, "Ethel, do you remember the day I came backstage to see you in Gypsy?" And she said, "Honey, I don't remember yesterday."
Oh.
It was very sad, and that's the last time I saw her.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, and I have you seen her Vell commercial on YouTube?
Yes.
Oh, it's not to be missed.
Yes, we'll post that for our listeners. Oh, no. We'll post all this for our listeners.
Yeah.
Besides Gypsy, do you remember any other big musicals that you... I mean, after that moment, did you start going back?
Oh, yes, yes. And thank God my father also loved the theater.
Great.
He also loved the theater. And I remember the second show was Take Me Along.
Oh.
With Jackie Gleason?
With Jackie Gleason and Walter Pidgeon.
Yeah.
And Eileen Hurley, who I eventually worked with in All My Children years later.
Oh, my gosh.
And the third show was Destry Rides Again at the Imperial.
Oh. Andy Griffith.
With Andy
Griffith.
Andy Griffith,
yeah.
Dolores,
Gray? Dolores Gray?
The fourth show was Do Re Mi.
I love Do Re Mi.
I adore Do Re Mi. It's a great score. Julie Stein, Compton and
Green. Yeah.
And in fact, there's an organization called Musicals Tonight.
Yes.
And they're doing it this year. Yeah, they're doing it in March.
I've already purchased my tickets.
It's legitimate. It's as pure as the driven snow.
Have you played Hubie Cram yet?
I have not finished singing.
I'm sorry.
No, don't stop, by all means.
No, I haven't. I had an opportunity about 20 years ago. I'm too old to play it now, but I'd love to play one of the gangsters.
That would be
great. That'd be funny, because that was a Davy Byrne show. He played Brains Berman.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about David Burns.
Okay. As I said, my father was in Wall Street,
yeah.
and he had show business clients, and Davey was one of them. So the first time I met Davey was after The Music Man.
Mm-hmm. And just for our listeners who don't know, because his name, you know, isn't as, you know, it's not like Alfred Drake. He's a brilliant actor.
Right.
He was the Mayor Shin.
Yes.
In
and
The Music
he
Man.
He won the Tony Award for Best Supporting Actor in a Musical in a role that didn't sing.
Wait a minute. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
He won two Tony Awards. He won one for playing the mayor, and then he won again a couple years later for Senex in Forum.
So yes. Senex in Forum. He did Do Re Mi, and then a Horse in... Hello, Dolly, right?
That's Horace. Yeah,
Horace,
yeah,
Van de Gelder,
right.
Yeah.
He was also nominated for Tony after he died for Lovely Ladies, Kind Gentlemen, which is on YouTube, by the way. You can see his performance on YouTube.
Can you really?
Yeah.
That I did not
there's
know.
About 45 minutes of the show that a friend of mine snuck in his camera, which was the size of Utah.
Right.
You know,
I mean,
in 1971.
Yeah.
It was an enormous, enormous thing. And he taped it from the back. And there's a couple of points I actually hear myself laughing because I saw just about every performance of Lovely Ladies.
And that was Tea House of August Moon? Is that what it was based on?
Tea House of August Moon.
Yeah.
It's a really good show that opened in a really wrong time.
Mm.
It was the height of the Vietnam War.
Oh, that's not
we didn't want to see Asians. Mm. We didn't want to see the army. We didn't want to see any of that. And I wish someplace like Musicals Tonight would do it. You know, it deserves it because the score is just wonderful.
Is there an album? Did they ever record an album?
My friend Robert Schur. Do you know Bob
yeah.
Schur, who does these studio recordings?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He did one about, God, it must be 20 years ago. And it's still in the can. And he said one of the problems is the fellow who played Davy's part was Mickey Rooney. He said was just...
got it.
Yeah.
Got it.
Know, shall we say no more?
Yeah. Understood. How did you and David then connect?
Well, my father introduced me to him after The Music Man and then kind of forbid me to see him because Davy Burns was the foulest mouthed human being. He was the most charming, the most dear, wonderful, sweet guy, but he had a mouth on him that was extraordinary.
Worse than Merman?
Yeah.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He made Merman look like a Girl Scout.
Oh, my gosh.
No, he just... And my father was not ready for... Of course, I was like 10 at that time. Then when Davey got into Forum, we went to see him in Forum. And we went upstairs to the dressing room, and he said, oh, yeah. He said, I haven't seen you. He said, well, you know, you're always welcome. And I said, do you really mean that? He said, of course I do. Well, I was there every night, just
Jeez.
About, just sitting in the dressing room.
Wow.
But it wasn't until Dolly, and then he got me this job working for the Golub Brothers. And the Golub Brothers owned all the concessions in all the Broadway theaters.
Right.
So this was my job in high school, that I got to stand at the back of these Broadway theaters, Tovarish and you know, and Funny Girl and Dolly and Fiddler, and I would watch these every night, and that was my education.
Oh, it's a good
can
education.
Can you just repeat those shows one more time?
That's a good your season that you
Dolly, Fiddler, Funny Girl, Tovarish with the great Vivian Lee and Jean-Pierre Aumont. That's all. Can we say that together?
Jean-Pierre
Aumont. Thank you.
We did very good.
I just went long.
That's all I did. Yeah, I don't think your Aumont was very good.
You will not get your honorary beret and baguette on the way out. This is amazing. So were you able to talk to the actors?
Oh, yes, of course. That's how I got to know Zero originally. Zero was, I came backstage one night. I used to just run back. I'd get a 50-cent seat up in the... mezzanine. Can you imagine a 50-cent seat for a I'm so old. So I would run down, and Davey's dressing room was on the third floor, and there was an elevator at the Alvin. I never call it what it is today.
The theater
is always the Alvin.
Always the Alvin to you.
Always the Alvin to me. One night, I come backstage and smack ran into Zero Mostel. Now, the first night I saw Forum, I had no idea who Zero Mostel was. Huh. You know, I was a kid in high school.
Yeah.
How would I know who that was? The curtain went up, and this man, I felt myself going back in the seat. You know, like somebody had stepped on the accelerator. I mean, he was a force of nature. He was the funniest thing I'd ever seen on a stage. And so this night, where are you going? I said, Mr. Mostel, I'm going to see Davy Burns. Well, you never come to see me. And I said, well, can I? Yes, mandatory. So I would go hang out with Zero for a few minutes. And the first night I went back to see Zero, there was a dancer in the show named David Evans, who was one of the three Proteans, who went on to Dolly. David was one of the great chorus guys of all time. And he was just reading him the riot act, screaming at David Evans for something he had done. And I was in military school, so I had my uniform on. And I mean, he's crushed, lion, don't you ever do that again, or I'll throw you in the orchestra pit. Now get out of here. And he turned to me, oh, Sergeant Brochus, so nice to see you. Oh, I mean, on a dime, he turned. And I was terrified of Zero. God. I really was quite terrified of him for a while. But he was a pussycat. The second night of Fiddler on the Roof, I was going to college. So my best friend from college and I flew to New York for the second performance of Fiddler on the Roof.
Wow.
My seat was A105, first row center.
Oh.
I didn't know what to expect. I heard it was a great show. Well, that was another unforgettable religious experience. Yeah. So my friend, I said, I know Zero. Come on backstage. We'll go see him. So my friend and I went back and hung out with Zero for a while. And then he took me upstairs to introduce me to his friend, Maria Kanilova. And we hung out with her for a while. And then we went up to Times Square. I'll never forget this. And talked about the future. And he was studying piano composition. And he wanted to be Broadway's greatest composer and have three shows running at one time. And he did. It was Stephen Schwartz.
Oh.
So Stephen Schwartz was your buddy.
My buddy. Still is my buddy.
My God.
Yeah. He was here. We had a party a couple of months ago, and he was here.
You are so lucky, and they're just as lucky to know you.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you. But I know how blessed I am with the people who have... Yeah. Come through my life.
Oh, yeah.
Where was school for you? Where were you at college?
Well, at Carnegie Tech.
Were you able to perform while at Carnegie Tech?
Not the first year. They made us... I remember Stephen wrote a little playlet for the Black Box Theater that I was in. And I remember him. It was a rather serious play. And Stephen Schwartz turned to me, you know, at the tender age of 17.
Yeah.
And said, you know, you'd paint your ass blue for a laugh. And I said, what shade?
What was the, if you can just pick one, what was the biggest lesson that David Burns taught you about acting or about being a human being, being an artist?
Never look back. I'll never forget him saying to me that, never look back. Yeah, and he got me my first stock job. When he was doing The Price, a fellow by the name of Joe Hayes came backstage, and he had four Zavarian brothers from Zavarian High School in Brooklyn. And Joe was the producer of the Surflight Summer Theater in Beach Haven, New Jersey.
Oh,
he started in 1950.
Yeah.
So they did 12 musicals in 12 weeks. So Joe and Davey, I think Joe was a chorus boy in like Out of This World or you know, one of those shows. So they knew each other. And Davey said, give Jim a job. You know, give him, he's very good. And Joe said, oh, the auditions are next Friday. Come to the Jerry Leroy Studios, you know, 753 8th Avenue, between 45th and 46th. What a toilet that was. No, really, it was. It was just the most horrible place. But right opposite, because he used it a lot, but right opposite where the audition room was Luigi's class.
Oh, yeah.
The great Luigi, who just left us a couple of months ago at the ripe old age of 90, I think he was. Oh, he was an amazing man. So we used to watch. So I went to the auditions, and Joe said, sing. And my big song was I'll Never Say No. So I said, I'll never say thank you. Come back to the callbacks. And I went to the callbacks, and he didn't even have me read. The very first show that we did 12 musicals in 12 weeks.
That's incredible.
But it was the greatest summer I ever had in my life. Yeah. You know, I was working. I was in the theater. Yeah. I was rehearsing during the day and performing to full houses at night. The first show we did was The Music Man.
Oh.
And I was Mayor Shin.
Oh, my gosh.
Full circle.
And opening night, Davy Burns was in the front row.
I mean.
I went to Pennsylvania. They gave me the day off to go get him. So I schlepped up to East Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. It was like a four-hour drive each way. And he came, and he was in the front row, and he said, and Joe was very religious, so he always had a priest bless the theater on the first performance. And the priest blesses the theater, and then Joe was so excited. He said, and the original mayor of the Music Man, David Burns, he's here. He's in the front row. David, would you say a few words? And
oh.
He got up, and he said, well, Joe, I'm very happy that tonight we're going to see the Music Man done the way it was originally intended to be performed in the nude. And I thought Joe was going to fall off the stage. It was a great performance. It was a great show. Oh, I loved doing it, but to have him looking at me doing an imitation of him as the mayor.
Totally.
So at the end of the show, I said, so you've never seen The Music Man. You know, you were in it, but you never saw it. What do you think? He said, it needs work.
What a great guy, though. I mean, he came all the way to see you in that show. I mean, what a great relationship.
I just adored him. Oh, and that night, it was at the 46th Street Theater.
Uh-huh.
That's another theater that will always be the 46th Street Theater to me. And so the brothers wanted to see the stage, and they had the orchestra pit covered with black velour. And we came out, and we were by the stage door, and you could see the stage that way. And Joe Hayes said, can we bring the brothers onto the stage and show them the stage? And Davey said, I don't care. Go ahead. We're going. And so we started the stage door, and all of a sudden we heard, and one of the brothers had stepped onto the black velour, went right to the floor, and Davey just turned to me and said, keep going.
What a mentor.
What a mentor.
I mean, and then after I would be finished selling the orange drink, I'd go back and hang out in his dressing room. We'd always go out. And it was surrealistic. The people who came into that dressing room, because Dolly was the biggest hit that ever was up until that time, and everybody wanted to see it. And one Wednesday matinee, I kid you not, I sat there watching Noel Coward eat Kentucky Fried Chicken with Colonel Sanders, the real guy. He used to bring buckets of chicken for publicity. Nobody knew who he was at that time. Nobody had any idea. And in fact, you can go to an old Merv Griffin show that's on TV, and you will see Davey and Colonel Sanders together. And nobody knew who he was. Colonel Sanders was sitting in the audience in his white suit, and and nobody had any idea who he was. This is 1965.
That's so random and amazing.
Now, when you were you auditioning
after I only did 1 year at Carnegie Tech. I got thrown out of every acting class I was in. It just seemed so stupid to me.
Yeah,
you know, I was learning by watching Zero.
Well,
and watching Davey and watching these, you know, Gielgud. Like he did a play called Tiny Alice that I went to see a couple of times just to watch him and to learn and try to absorb.
Yeah.
So I wasn't great in class. And at the end of a year, I knew it was not the right choice. And my father said, well, come back, but do get a degree. So I finished my degree at St. Francis College.
Brooklyn. Perfect. Yeah.
And as soon as I finished that, I started auditioning. And got my first off-Broadway show almost immediately called Unfair to Goliath down at the Cherry Lane Theater. And I remember the review in the New York Post. Jerry Talmer, who became a wonderful friend, who we also just lost last year at the age of 94, I think he was. Great guy. And he hated the show. He said, Unfair to Goliath is unfair to audiences. He said, but the cast is very fine indeed. Mm-hmm. And the cast was. There was four others in the cast, just five of us. He said, but Jim Brochu is my choice if they ever do the Zero Mostel story. Isn't that funny?
He already knew.
That's
so Jerry predicted it years and years. Foreshadowed it years before that.
When did you go out to California?
I went out to California in 75 for the first time.
Was the hope to do film and television out
there? No, I'm trying to. It was serendipitous that I went out there. Oh, I know what it was. I was visiting my friend Mary Jo Catlett, who was also in the original Dolly.
And a brilliant actress.
Oh, wonderful.
Brilliant actress.
Who replaced Charlotte Ray on Different Strokes.
Yes, she did.
Full circle. So I was just going to visit her for 2 weeks. And my agent from New York had moved out to California. So he said, do you want to audition while you're here? And I said, sure. Well, all of a sudden, I got a movie of the week called Law and Order. not what's D-Log. On now.
Yeah.
It was based on a book by Dorothy Unack. And it was typecasting. I played a child molester.
Welcome to L.A.
And got severely beaten up by Darren McGavin.
Well, if you're going to get beat up by anybody.
And then a couple of weeks later, I got a Kojak and got beaten up by Telly Savalas. Oh, so
what
I
a
got
resume.
Beat up a lot. Yeah. In fact, we did that Kojak was just on, so I have it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That's funny.
Quite
That's
fun.
That's really funny.
So I stayed. I was getting work.
Sure, yeah. Why leave?
And everybody I knew at that point seemed to be moving out to California. Stan Freeman, who was my best friend. Davey died in 71 on stage. At the Forest Theater during 70 Girls.
Did you get to see him in it before?
Oh,
he
I did. I used to drive him down to Philadelphia, and I'd sit in the Forest Theater for rehearsals and watch them put the show together. And the director was a fellow named Paul Aaron, the original director of it. And I remember sitting in the house, just empty, you know, and they had the work table up and how they were doing that stuff. And I was sitting with Nancy Andrews, who was the original Belle Poitrine in Little Me, the great Nancy Andrews.
Yeah.
So we were sitting there together, and Paul Aaron was directing this scene that involved Millie Natwick and Lillian Roth and Davey. Mm-hmm. And Paul Aaron said, David, let me show you how to get a laugh here. And everybody just froze. And everybody looked at Davey, and he said, yeah, Paul, come on up. Show me how to get a laugh. And, you know, and Nancy Andrews turned to me and said, would anyone have the gall to tell the Pope how to say Mass? The next day, Paul Aaron was replaced. And I used to see all the changes to 70 Girls and just loved that show so much.
It's a gorgeous score. It's just a gorgeous, marvelous score.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah. Every tune is absolutely joyful.
And you got to direct a production of it, correct?
I did. In fact, I was supposed to be in Philadelphia the night he died, March 12th, 1971. And I was going with Mary Jo Catlett. Mm-hmm. She was still here in New York. And that afternoon, she said, can we go to the matinee tomorrow? She said, I don't want to drive back late. I said, yeah. So I called Davey. He was at the Sylvania Hotel. Mm-hmm. And I said, we're coming tomorrow. He said, all right. And I said, are you okay? He said, I'm just tired. That's all. And that was the last conversation I had with him. Oh. I got a call that night from Tommy Breslin, who had done Go Visit Your Grandmother with him.
Yeah.
And but I drove to Philadelphia the next day to see the show. Yeah. And sat again with Nancy Andrews in the back of the Forest Theater. And Coley Wirth was his standby and did the show beautifully. And at the end, Coley took his bow and then went back to his chorus position and left the space open.
Wow.
I still get, you know.
Oh,
now you've made me cry, and I shall hate you. Remember those 4-for-a-quarter booths?
Yeah.
Well, Davey did the funniest drunk. And so one day we were walking up Broadway, and I pushed him into the booth, and I sat him on my lap, and I said, do the drunk, and I'll show you that picture.
We should tell our listeners that Jim's apartment is a musical theater fan's mecca. Photos everywhere of Ethel Merman and Carol Burnett and Barbara Streisand.
But very tastefully done.
But very tastefully done.
Very elegant.
In fact,
very elegant.
It's wonderful because I'm looking at Jim, and behind him there's a huge picture of Zero Mostel, and it
doing
fits
Rich Man
perfectly.
Yeah.
That's right.
You did get
to say nothing of our
the view that I'm looking at.
We have a beautiful, beautiful view.
It's a stunning view, isn't it? We're so lucky to have this.
Gorgeous. Absolutely. And you said you can look into Michelle Lee's window? Is
that
right across the way?
That's true. Yeah, she had a party last Sunday, and we were flicking lights. And I said, look, you can see my my balcony from here.
I flick lights at the drug dealers on the corner, and I say, can you stop, please?
I just call them.
I just call them. Just come on out.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUPS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUPS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUPSMusical.com.
Crazy.
The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
So when you were in L.A., you were involved with the El Portal Theater, is that correct?
The El Portal, Central for the Arts, yeah.
Which was located, or is located, I should say.
Lancashire Boulevard.
Lancashire Boulevard.
It was built in 1926 as a movie house.
Yeah.
And they asked me to be the artistic director.
Wow.
And I really hated it.
Oh.
I really hated it, yeah, because I was all of a sudden an administrator. I was a producer.
Oh, it's different, yeah.
And it was an acting company of 80 people, wow. You know, all thinking that they were Dusa and Olivier put together. And so it was dealing with 80 egos and trying to pick stuff that, you know, and all of a sudden 9/11 happened. And nobody wanted to buy a subscription. They didn't know what was going to happen next Thursday.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So that dried up, you know, and it just wasn't fun. So I said goodbye to that, and then we came back to New York to do Zero Hour.
Great.
And, you know, I was home, and we realized we didn't want to go back.
That's wonderful. Well, we're happy you're here.
I'm happy you're here, Robert. Thank you.
When you were in L.A., though, we were talking about this before. We have to ask about a show that's on your website.
Uh-oh.
Oedipus Schmedipus.
As long as you love your mother.
That's a full title. Full title. One more time. Oedipus Schmedipus.
As long as you love your mother.
Which had book, music, and lyrics by the great...
Yeah, the great Rue McClanahan was the book, music, and the lyrics. And it was Forum, except in Greece. And it was really a very clever score. And it was a funny book. She was great. I adored Rue. I absolutely adored her.
I had no idea.
I didn't know she wrote music. I mean, that's incredible.
She wasn't the greatest lyricist.
Sure.
If she wrote, you know, she'd rhyme oogly with boogly. You know, I'd say.
Sometimes she's not.
I'd say, well, what does it mean? Doesn't matter. Just sing it. So, just sing
it. Like a true writer. Just sing it.
Right.
And we had more fun with that. And then we became very, very close.
Yeah.
You know, and we knew all the Golden Girls, which was really kind of fun.
Oh,
yeah.
Well.
We were having dinner one night at Jerry's Deli. And this waitress came along and said, can I take your... Oh, my God, you're B. Arthur. Oh, you know, you're so tall. And I'm tall, too, because I want to be an actress. And they said, well, if B. Arthur is tall and you can be an actress, then you can be an actress and I'm tall and you're tall. But, you know, I don't know if I'm as good as you are, but you're tall. And then, and finally, B. just looked at me and said, what the fuck is she talking about?
That's exactly right.
It's the right answer. What the fuck is she talking about? How did the last session come about for you?
Well, Steve was dying. My partner was dying of AIDS, and we had done all the last things, and he was in the hospital. He was on an IV, and then he won the lottery for the drug, for Crixivan, and Crixivan was only available to like 1,100 people in the country, and he won this lottery, so he became one of the test patients for Crixivan. And it changed everything. Within 2 weeks, he was putting on weight again.
Oh, my gosh.
And he was getting energy again. And so he went into he had been running a place called the National Academy of Songwriters in Los Angeles. And he put his own songwriting career on hold. He had always been a songwriter to help other people establish their, you know, their work. And, in fact, it's really funny. A guy came in who wanted to be a lyricist and a songwriter, and Steve, and he became very good friends, and he was very shy, and he was very attracted to a girl in the office named Blythe. So Steve played matchmaker and brought them together, and they got married, and then he said, we were having dinner one night, and he said, you know, I really want to be a writer. My Lucy book had just come out at that point. He said, I said, well, what do you want to write about? He said, well, I think I could write a good thriller. And he was teaching at that point at Exeter. They moved and they were living up in New Hampshire. And I said, well, the only thing you can do is just do it, you know, find the time. So he used to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and go to the typewriter, finished his first book, which was called Digital Fortress. There's a copy of it over there. His second book was more successful. His third book was called Angels and Demons,
yeah.
And his fourth book was called The Da Vinci Code.
Oh, my goodness.
So Dan Brown was a very, very important part of our lives.
Oh,
and and he and Blythe. And Blythe was an art historian. So it was like the perfect couple. She did all the research for the books, and then Dan
that's incredible.
Would do it.
Wow.
Anyway, that's a side sidebar.
That was a good one.
So anyway, Steve wrote a song about his experience in the hospital when he was dying. It was called Connected. Connected to an IV, connected to a bottle, connected to a TV. And then at the end of the song was that we're all connected to each other.
Mm.
Well, he came into the living room and started to play. Neither one of us could get through it. I just started weeping.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw that the creative process was being as helpful to his health and bringing him back to life as the drugs were. So I started to give him homework assignments. I said, write a song called Somebody's Friend about how everybody has a cure, but you never can meet them. And write a song about your own memorial service called Save Me a Seat. So I kept giving him these assignments. He wrote about five or six songs. And he said, well, what are you going to do? He said, if I die, these songs go nowhere. He said, where's the play? Write a play. You're a playwright. I'm a songwriter. And I had no idea what to do. And then it was Thanksgiving, I think 1995. And we were at a friend's house who had a recording studio in the house. And Steve was playing and a couple other people were doing backup. And all I can say was a flash of grace, whatever that was. I saw the whole play in my head. And I went back that night. And the first thing I did was design the set of a recording studio. And the play was written in a week.
Wow.
In a week. And we did a benefit for ASCAP. They asked if we would do the last session as a benefit at the Cinegrill at the Roosevelt Hotel. And the place came apart.
Wow.
And we knew we had something at that point. Then the fellow who had produced Oedipus Schmedipus, how all this comes together,
yeah.
owned the Golden Theater in Burbank. He was all of 18 years old at that point. His name was Carl White. So Carl said, he said, I want to go to New York. I want to be a producer. I want to be the next Cameron McIntosh. And I said, then you have to close your most successful theater and just do it and start at the bottom. And I said, if you do that, you can produce the last session. And he said, that's a deal. Gave up the theater, came to New York, started to work for the Weislers.
Oh.
He produced the last session. Now he's a two-time Tony Award winner. He runs Martian Entertainment.
That's amazing. That's
yeah.
I mean.
So he produced the last session. We opened at the 47th Street Theater, October of 1997.
Yeah.
And this man was in the audience who came up to us afterwards, and he said, "He said, you know, I don't always know the work I do, which is so isolated, that it affects people like that. But my name is Dr. Bruce Dorsey, and I synthesized Crixivan." So the man who saved his life was at the opening night.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. It's quite an astonishing story.
What a gift.
Yeah, so that's the last session.
That you gave each other.
Yeah.
Wow.
Then we did the Big Voice.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask about next.
The Laguna Playhouse saw it in New York, and they wanted to be the first regional producers of the last session, which was an enormous hit for them. And here was a gay-themed show about AIDS, and,
yeah.
and it sold out every night. It really changed the theater's history as they got religious conservatives in and all of a sudden selling subscriptions. So the artistic director, Richard Stein, he and I became friends, and he said, look, we're doing three Monday nights. This was a couple of years later. He said, we're doing three special nights. Susan Egan is doing one. Charles Nelson Reilly is doing the other. And you and Steve come down and be the third night. And I said, to do what? He said, well, you know, sing a couple of new songs, talk about the last session, about your lives, and just improvise it. And I can't improvise. I'm very bad at that. So I sat down and I wrote The Big Voice.
And what is The Big Voice about?
Well, The Big Voice is the story I told you at the beginning, when I knew I was destined to be the first Brooklyn-born Pope, met Ethel Merman, and she changed my life. So it was the dichotomy between religion and show business.
Yeah.
So the Big Voice, was it God or was it Ethel Merman? And
it's a question we all ask
and
ourselves.
We do.
I mean, really.
And then we opened the Actors Temple Theater,
yes.
on 47th Street with that show. We ran 6 months. And then at that point, I had written Zero Hour and had commitments to do that. So actually, we were playing ourselves in the Big Voice, but two guys took over for us, playing us.
Had you always wanted to be a writer? I mean, how did that come to fruition for you?
That's funny. Kevin, I was doing Fiddler in Kansas City in 1980, mm-hmm. and I had always dabbled with writing. And it was the producer was a wonderful guy named Richard Carruthers, and he was producing Under the Yum Yum Tree.
Oh.
And I said, that's a terrible play. He said it took that man 2 years to write that play. I said, oh, for crying out loud, I can write you a bad play in a week. So I rented a typewriter in Kansas City, and I wrote Cooking with Gus. My first play, which is 30 years later, is done to death. It's just one of the great shocks of my life that anybody would ever do this horrible play. But there's a production running. There's two productions running now, one in Canada and one in Wisconsin.
I hope they don't hear this.
So they can hear this.
It's not in French. The Canadians can't hear it.
And it was done in French. It's like the Odd Couple in French Canada called Les Pieds dans la Plage. It's
amazing.
Huge in Canada.
That's cool,
no,
Jim.
It really is. It's huge in Canada. And So I won the bet that I could write a bad play in 1 week.
And so that got it started. All right.
It's been paying off for you like crazy ever since.
It really has been wonderful. And then I wrote a play called Lady of the House for Rue. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote one for Kathleen Freeman, who we talked about, called The Lucky O'Learys. And she did it. And a fellow who was in The Lucky O'Learys just passed away this week, George Gaines.
Oh. Love George
Gaines. Oh, he was wonderful. God, he was wonderful. That voice, that great booming voice. Yeah.
Most people remember him from the Police Academy movies.
Of course.
And he was Punky Brewster's guardian on
that's
Punky
right.
Brewster.
Oh, that's right.
But a great actor. Yeah. Vanya on 42nd Street, if anybody's seen that.
He gave me one of the great laughs in The Lucky O'Learys just because he misread something. He was playing the Monsignor, Dollar Bill Rafferty. Who was always collecting money for the new gymnasium or the new rectory or the new this. And he said, and the line was, you know, I'm collecting money so we can break ground. And so he is in front of 500 people. And he said, and we're collecting the money so I can break wind. Ground!
Well, the lucky
speak up, Kevin.
Yeah. Lucky O'Learys, didn't that?
I refuse to talk about.
Bring
that.
Your relationship to start your relationship with Lucy.
Absolutely,
as well. Isn't that true? Can you tell
yeah.
us about that?
Well, it's so funny. I knew Kate Hepburn, and I had written this play about the two sisters. Originally, I actually had Maureen Stapleton in mind and Kathleen Freeman do the two sisters, and Kate said I'd be horribly miscast. And you should get Lucille. And I said, Paul? She said, yes. I said, do you know how to get in touch with her? No. Hang up. That was the end of the conversation. So it just so happened that I ran into this guy who had just produced Stone Pillow.
Yeah.
Named Merrill Karpf, who a wonderful producer. And he said, yeah, she'd be right for it. And I said, can you put me in touch. He said, no, you got to do that yourself. But if she asks me about you, I'll give you a good recommendation. I didn't know how to get in touch with her. Steve and I went down to Hollywood Boulevard. We got a Maps to the Stars homes.
Oh.
And there was Lucille Ball, 1000 North Roxbury Drive. Now, I had taken a class with Lucy in 1977 at the Sherwood Oaks Experimental College.
Wow.
She gave a 6-week seminar on comedy and acting. And you had to go. She sat in a director's chair at the front. There was probably about 100 people in the class. And you had to come with questions. She really didn't teach, but she answered everything. And somebody gave me last year a tape of that first class. And she and I got into a fight. She and I got into a fight because she thought using pejorative words on All in the Family was terrible. And I said, but I think it makes Archie look so stupid that you realize there's no power in these. So anyway, I got her address and I wrote her a note. And I said, I've written this play. Merrill Karpf and Kate Hepburn think you'd be very right for it. I took your comedy class in 1977. I'd love you to read this. And I play backgammon. And 2 days later, the phone rang. Jim, this is Lucy. So I read your play. You made me laugh for the first time in 2 years.
Oh, my God.
Because she had not gotten over the Life with Lucy series that she was fired from.
Where they treated her so poorly.
Treated her so badly. She told me the day that they got the word and they had to leave, she said she was carrying out her makeup case and people turned their back. They didn't want to look at her. And she said she cried for a year. Well, anyway, so she said, can you come over and talk about the play? And I said, yeah. Well, it turned out she was looking to do something with Audrey Meadows. And I thought, well, they'd be perfect together. Got over to the house. She opened the door herself. She was all in white. And I'm thinking, dear God, this is my idol. This is the lady who taught me so much about comedy. Oh, and I think the fourth show I saw was Wildcat.
At the
Alvin, at the Alvin Theater. So anyway, we went to the back house. And she said the backgammon table was there. She said, well, sit down. We'll have a game. So I sat down. Crack. I broke her chair. I sit down and I break the woman's chair. And I didn't know whether to just freeze and not say anything or to admit what I had done. So I can't sit this way for an hour. And I said, Miss Ball, oh, call me Lucy. I said, well, Lucy, I just broke your chair. She said, well, get another one. Oh, okay. La, la, la. And I went over and I got another chair, put that down. Crack. Now I've broken two chairs in the space of 2 minutes. I said, see the ship pulling out?
Yeah, I've been watching it.
So I said, why don't I get that one? That one looks sturdy. She said, the other two look sturdy too. Oh. Well, she tried to tell me a joke, which I also can't repeat on this. I'll tell you guys afterwards. But it was, she screwed up the joke so badly. And what I said back to her just sent her into hysterics. I mean, she literally fell off the chair. And I realized at that point I could make Lucille Ball laugh.
Yeah.
And I was relentless. And she actually was holding herself on the floor. And I said, don't you die. I don't want to be in the Inquirer next week that I killed Lucille Ball. Which sent her into hysterics even more.
Oh, wow.
So at the end of the day, we had talked about everything but the play. Mm-hmm. And she said, can you come back tomorrow? And I said, yeah, but tomorrow's my birthday, so if I come back, you have to give me a present. She said, maybe I'll give you a chair. So I got back the next day, and we were playing, and I won the first day.
That's right.
I beat her by $1, which let her know that I was a good backgammon player and would be a good opponent for her, which she liked, you know, and she had no other activities to do, so she really looked forward to that time. So I got back the next day, and we were playing, and she excused herself for a second, went into the corner, and she came back with a hot cross bun with a candle in it, singing, happy birthday to you, and I started to cry. And she said, what are you crying for? And I said, well, did Lucille Ball ever sing happy birthday to you? And she gave me a little green foil-wrapped box. And I opened it up, and there was a watch inside with her little face with the note, Jim, I will always have time for you. Love, Lucy.
Oh.
And I spent pretty much every day with her until that last day.
It's a wonderful book, and we'll post a link to it on Amazon for all of our listeners. But please read it. It's a fascinating...
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Jeez.
It's a labor of love, you know. I just loved her. She changed my life in so many ways. And to be able to be with her for that last year was a remarkable time of my life.
Yeah.
And I just...
Special for her, too, it seems.
I think so, because all of her friends had died.
Yeah.
But you see in the book, she starts to blossom again. I mean, from the beginning of the book, when she seems a little guarded, and then as it goes on, it's very clear that you brought a lot of joy into her life.
It was really, you know, and we'd go over. Gary Morton, he'd go to Palm Springs, and he would play golf, and so she would invite us over for dinner, and she'd have Paula Stewart, and she'd have Thelma, and this one night we were in the formal dining room, and Gary wasn't there, so she said, sit at the other end of the table, and I thought, I'm sitting where Desi used to sit. This was their home.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the houseman came in. Yes, madam. And she said, well, what do you want? He said, what do you want? And she said, well, I don't want anything. He said, oh, yes, madam. And so he went out again. And we're in the middle of a conversation 2 minutes later, and he comes through the door. Yes, madam. What do you want? No, madam, what do you want? I don't want anything. Yes, madam. And he'd go back in a few minutes later. Yes, madam. What do you want? She said, no, what do you want? He said, He said, madam, you keep hitting the button on the floor. There was a little
button
on the floor.
Oh, my God, the call button.
The call button that you would press, and it would go off in the kitchen. So she didn't know that. And she served stuffed cabbage that night. I'll never forget that. Wow. Stuffed cabbage. And we were all kind of playing. And she said, do you like stuffed cabbage? And I said, not really. She said, well, I hate it. What the hell are we eating stuffed cabbage for?
You know, you've had so many great mentors. Is there anybody that you mentor now? Have you thought about teaching at any
point? No, I don't like people.
Great. Well, we'll leave now. So, Jim, this was a pleasure.
There, you know, I'm so lucky. I feel like I'm a link in a chain. And I can't say that I'm his mentor, but I'm certainly older, and we work together. A fellow named Josh Grissetti.
Oh, yeah. Yes, Josh
Grissetti. Who is just
very talented.
Beyond talented. And you know, there's a couple of young people I met doing Sound of Music that I'm in touch with, who I've encouraged to, you know, follow their dreams and be that and help. And so I feel that I'm a link in that chain, and hopefully I've passed on, you know, what Davey had given to me.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about Green Willow at the Equity Library
Theater? Oh, my God.
And maybe a little bit about the Equity Library Theater. Some of our younger audience members might not be familiar with that. What they stood
for,
what they
did. Yeah, the Equity Library Theater was a very, very, very special place. Mm-hmm. I think it was in existence for maybe about 10, 20 years. Mm-hmm. And the show I did was about 1971 or 72, and it was Frank Lesser's Green Willow.
Great score.
Great score. Yeah. The music of Home and Never Will I Marry.
Yeah.
And the original was Cecil Kellaway and I forget who played. Oh, Bill Chapman, my darling friend Bill Chapman, played the two ministers.
Oh, yes.
And it was, they did shows that other people didn't do. It was at a place called the Masters Theater. It was 103rd and Riverside Drive.
Oh.
I think it's still there, but it's not a theater anymore. And you would get, you didn't get paid. But everybody, every agent, every casting director. So you did it as a showcase.
Yeah.
And you did it with just the most extraordinary actors. You know, there were stars who used to do ELT. Mm-hmm. And they had a wonderful director named Bobby Nigro. And Bobby directed Search for Tomorrow, but he was a wonderful theater director and gone too soon. His only Broadway credit was Is There Life After High School.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And he directed P.S. Your Cat Is Dead off-Broadway, and you know, but he's left us now. But it was a great experience, and we just had more fun doing it. And I think I got an agent out of it. I'm not sure. It was so long ago.
I wish there was more like that now for our students.
I really do. I know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we mentioned musicals tonight. Is they sort of dust off old shows
right.
that we don't get to see very often.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things on YouTube that I watch when I'm in like a bad mood or a sad mood, I just have to tell you, is your dinner with Charles Nelson Reilly.
Oh, Robert.
Makes me so happy. Have you seen this?
No.
It is one of the funniest things.
Charles was a very dear friend. He was as crazy as they came, just as crazy as he was totally insane. And he wouldn't go to the theater. He refused to go to the theater, except he would bring everybody to the last session when we were doing it at the Tiffany. He came at least once a week.
Huh.
He had to sit by the door because in 1944, he went to the circus in Hartford, Connecticut, and it was the Great Fire that killed 44 people. And he was in the midst of that. So he still had terrors about being part of an audience. So he would have, this was, the night you're talking about was the Tony Awards. I think it was the year 2000, 2001. And we went up. And he was, there was a girl there named Anastasia Barzee.
Yes.
Wonderful actress. Yeah. And a couple of other people. And Charles was just possessed that night. just possessed. He and whenever he was entertaining, he wore a nightshirt and his slippers.
Yeah.
You know, and he made turkey. It was always a turkey dinner. And it's called Our Dinner with Charles, and I edited it down to about 3 minutes, but he's quite funny on it that night.
It's hysterical. We're going to post it to our Facebook page.
Oh, good.
So our listeners can see it as well, because it makes me so happy.
You know, it makes me happy too, Robert, when I look at that. He brings back very, very fond memories. Mm. You know, he was just crazy but wonderful, and I produced his... Save It for the Stage.
Yeah, I was just going to say, there's an award behind you that you received.
There?
Yeah. The Valley Theater League Artistic Director Achievement for Save It for the Stage.
Oh, see, I didn't even know.
Oh, yeah.
You're pointing out awards. I've won so many awards, I've just forgotten how.
There is. And deservedly so. And Save It for the Stage is available on...
I don't know. It is available. I mean, he and I got into some problems with it because it was 3 hours and 20 minutes.
Oh.
You know, and I kept saying, you got to cut it, but it's all too good. And I said, no, it's not all too good. And so one night in his dressing room, his producer and his director were just on top of him to cut this show. And finally, he just said, Jimmy, take me home. As soon as the curtain came down, and this is not talking out of school, he had a flask of bourbon. And he would start downing the bourbon as soon as the curtain came down. And we got into my car. He was in the passenger seat. Didn't say a word. We go up Coldwater Canyon, where he lived. We got to the top of Mulholland Drive. And all of a sudden, he screamed, they're the Ramses, and I'm John Benet, and they're killing me! I almost drove off Mulholland Drive.
And I'm John Benet.
One of the funniest things he ever said to me, there's a thing called the Pageant of the Arts in Laguna Beach, where people do stills and they open it up.
Oh.
And they're the paintings.
Yes. I know what you're talking about.
I called him and I said, look, I got an extra ticket for the Pageant of the Arts. He said, what, I should drive 2 hours to see some dental assistant be the Mona Lisa?
Join us next week where we interview our favorite casting director of Sondheim shows, Joanna Merlin.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.